The insomnia is really bad these days, I lied. You're exhausted, plain and simple. She scribbled on her prescription pad. According to that book you're holding, the death gene is passed from mother to child in the birth canal. Something about microdermabrasions and infectious vaginal rash. Does your mother exhibit any signs of hormonal abnormalities? I don't think so. You might want to ask her. If you are a carrier, I can suggest something for you. An herbal lotion. Only if you want it. I'd have to order it special from Peru. I was born cesarean, in case that's a factor. The noble method, she said. Ask her anyway. Her answer might shed some light on your mental and biorhythmic incapacities. Well, she's dead, I reminded her. Dr. Tuttle put her pen down and folded her hands into prayer. I thought she was going to sing a song or do some incantation. I didn't expect her to offer me any pity or sympathy, but instead, she squinched up her face, sneezed violently, turned to wipe her face with a huge bath towel lying on the floor by her desk chair, and scribbled on her pad some more. "And how did she die?" she asked. "Not pineal failure, I suppose." "She mixed alcohol with sedatives," I said. I was too lethargic to lie. And if Dr. Tuttle had forgotten that I'd told her my mother had slit her wrists, telling her the truth wouldn't matter in the long run. "People like your mother," Dr. Tuttle replied, shaking her head, "give psychotropic medication a bad reputation." September came and went. The sunlight tilted through the blinds once in a while, and I'd peek out to see if the leaves on the trees were dying yet. Life was repetitive, resonated at a low hum. I shuffled down to the Egyptians. I filled my prescriptions. Riva continued to appear from time to time, usually drunk and always on the brink of hysteria or outrage or complete meltdown one way or another. In October, she barged in while I was watching Working Girl.
"This again?"
she huffed and threw herself down in the armchair.
"I'm fasting for Yom Kippur."
She sighed boastfully. This was not unusual. She'd been on some truly insane diets in the past. A gallon of salt water a day. Only prune juice and baking soda.
"I can have as much sugar-free jello as I want before 11 a.m.
Or,
"I'm fasting," she'd say. "I'm fasting on weekends. I'm fasting every other weekday." "Melanie Griffith looks bulimic in this movie,"
Riva said now, pointing lazily at the screen.
"See her swollen jowls? Her face looks fat, but her legs are super skinny. Or maybe she's just fat with skinny legs. Her arms look soft, don't they? I could be wrong. I don't know. I'm kind of out of it. I'm fasting," she said again.
"That's not puking. It's boozing, Riva," I told her, slurping drool from the corner of my mouth. "Not every skinny person has an eating disorder." It was the most I'd said in weeks to anyone.
"Sorry," Riva said. "You're right. I'm just in a mood. I'm fasting, you know."
She dug around in her purse and pulled out her dwindling fifth of tequila.
"Want some?"
she asked. "No." She cracked open a Diet Mountain Dew. We watched the movie in silence. In the middle, I fell back asleep. October was placid. The radiator hissed and sputtered, releasing a sharp, vinegary smell that reminded me of my dead parents' basement, so I rarely turned on the heat. I didn't mind the cold. My visit to Dr. Tuttle that month was relatively unremarkable. "How is everything at home?" she asked. "Good? Bad? Other?" "Other," I said. "Do you have a family history of non-binary paradigms?" When I explained for the third time that both my parents had died, that my mother had killed herself, Dr. Tuttle unscrewed the cap of her value-size bottle of Afrin, twirled around in her chair, tilted her head back so that she was looking at me upside down, and started sniffing. "I'm listening," she said. "It's allergies, and now I'm hooked on this nasal spray. Please continue. Your parents are dead and..." And nothing. It's fine, but I'm still not sleeping well. What a conundrum. She twirled back around and put her Afrin in her desk drawer. Here, let me give you my latest samples. She got up to open her little cabinet and filled a brown paper lunch bag with packets of pills. Trick or treat, she said, dropping in a mint from the bowl on her desk. Dressing up for Halloween? Maybe I'll be a ghost. Economical, she remarked. I went home and went to sleep. Outside of the occasional irritation, I had no nightmares, no passions, no desires, no great pains. And during this lull in the drama of sleep, I entered a stranger, less certain reality. Days slipped by obliquely, with little to remember, just the familiar dent in the sofa cushions, the froth of scum in the bathroom sink like some lunar landscape, craters bubbling on the porcelain when I washed my face or brushed my teeth. But that was all that went on. And I might have just dreamt up the scum. Nothing seemed really real. Sleeping, waking, it all collided into one gray, monotonous plane ride through the clouds. I didn't talk to myself in my head. There wasn't much to say. This was how I knew the sleep was having an effect. I was growing less and less attached to life. If I kept going, I thought, I'd disappear completely, then reappear in some new form. This was my hope. This was the dream. Chapter 3. In November, however, an unfortunate shift occurred. The carefree tranquility of sleep gave way to a startling subliminal rebellion. I began to do things while I was unconscious. I'd fall asleep on the sofa and wake up on the bathroom floor. Furniture got rearranged. I started to misplace things. I made blackout trips to the bodega and woke up to find popsicle sticks on my pillow, orange and bright green stains on my sheets, half a huge sour pickle, empty bags of barbecue-flavored potato chips, tiny cartons of chocolate milk on the coffee table, the tops of them folded and torn and gummy with teeth marks. When I came to after one of these blackouts, I'd go down to get my coffees as usual, try a little chit-chat on the Egyptians in order to gauge how weirdly I'd acted the last time I was in there. Did they know that I'd been sleepwalking? Had I said anything revealing? Had I flirted? The Egyptians were generally indifferent and returned the standard chit-chat or flat-out ignored me, so it was hard to tell. It concerned me that I was venturing out of the apartment while unconscious. It seemed antithetical to my hibernation project. If I committed a crime or got hit by a bus, the chance for a new and better life would be lost. If my unconscious excursions went only as far as the bodega around the corner, that was okay, I thought. I could live. The worst that could happen was I'd make a fool of myself in front of the Egyptians and would have to start going to the deli a few blocks farther down First Avenue. I prayed that my subconscious understood the value of convenience. Amen. This was when my online purchasing of lingerie and designer jeans began in earnest. It seemed that while I was sleeping, some superficial part of me was taking aim at a life of beauty and sex appeal. I made appointments to get waxed. I booked time at a spa that offered infrared treatments and colonics and facials. One day, I canceled my credit card in the hope that doing so might deter me from filling my non-existent date book with the frills of someone I used to think I was supposed to be. A week later, a new credit card showed up in the mail. I cut it in half. My stress levels rose. I couldn't trust myself. I felt as though I had to sleep with one eye open. I even considered installing a video camera to record myself while I was unconscious, but I knew that would only prove to be a document of my resistance to my project. It wouldn't stop me from doing anything, since I'd be unable to watch it until I woke up for real. So I was in a state of panic. I doubled my Xanax dosage in an attempt to counteract my anxiety. I lost track of the days, and as a result, missed my visit to Dr. Tuttle in November. She called and left me a message. I'll have to charge you for the missed appointment. Let me remind you, you did sign the agreement to my office policy. There's a 24-hour cutoff for cancellations. Most doctors in the area require you to cancel 36 or 48 hours before the scheduled appointment, so I think I'm being pretty generous. And it concerns me that you'd be so flip about your mental health. Call me to reschedule. The ball is in your basket. She sounded stern. I felt terrible. But when I called to apologize and make another appointment, she was back to normal. See you Thursday, she said. Toodaloo. Halfway through the month, my internet use began to rise even more. I woke up with my laptop screen filled with AOL chat room conversations with strangers in places like Tampa and Spokane and Park City, Utah. In my waking hours, I rarely thought of sex, but in my medicated blackouts, I guess my lusts arose. I scrolled through the transcripts. They were surprisingly polite. How are you? I'm fine, thanks. How are you? Horny much? It went on from there. I was relieved I never gave anyone my real name. My AOL screen name was Whoopi Girlberg 2000. Call me Whoopi. Call me Reva, I once wrote. The photos men sent of their genitals were all banal, semi-erect, non-threatening. Your turn, they'd write. Usually I changed the subject. What's your favorite movie? Then one day, I woke up to discover that I had dug out my digital camera and sent a bunch of strangers snapshots of my asshole, my nipple, the inside of my mouth. I'd written messages saying that I'd like it if they came and tied me up and held me hostage and slurped my pussy like a plate of spaghetti. And there were numbers in my cell phone log I didn't recognize. So I made up a rule that whenever I took my pills, which was roughly every 8 hours, I'd put my computer in the closet and power down my phone, seal it with packing tape in a Tupperware container, and stick the container in the back of a high kitchen cabinet. But then I woke up with the unopened Tupperware next to me on the pillow. The next night, the phone was on the window ledge, next to a dozen half-smoked cigarettes stubbed out on an Alanis Morissette CD case.
Why are you killing yourself? Reva asked, seeing the butts in the trash can when she came over uninvited a few days later.
Reva's mother's cancer had started in her lungs. My smoking has nothing to do with you or your mother. My mother's dead too, you know, I added. By this point, Reva's mother was in hospice care, in and out of consciousness. I was tired of hearing about it. It brought back too many memories. Plus, I knew she'd expect me to go to her mother's funeral. I really didn't want to do that.
My mom's not dead yet, Reva said.
I didn't tell Reva about my internet proclivities, but I did ask her to change my AOL password to something I could never guess. Just some random letters and numbers. I waste too much time online, I told her.
Doing what?
I send emails late at night and regret it, was the lie I knew she would believe.
To Trevor, right? She asked, nodding her head knowingly.
Reva changed my password, and once my AOL account was inaccessible, my sleep stayed low stakes for a while. The worst I did while I was unconscious was write letters to Trevor on a yellow legal pad, long petitions about our romantic history and how I wanted things to change so that we could be together again. The letters were so ridiculous, I wondered if they were written in my sleep to keep me entertained while I was awake. By the end of the month, my blackout excursions down to the bodega had become less frequent, maybe due to the onset of winter. Reva's visits became less frequent too, and her attitude shifted from melodrama to polite posturing. Instead of venting, she gave well-articulated summaries of her week, including the latest current events. I appreciated her self-control, I told her. She said she was trying to be more sensitive to my needs. When she would once have given me advice or commented on the state of the apartment, she now bit her tongue. She complained less. She also started giving me hugs and air kisses whenever she said goodbye. She did this by bending over me on the sofa. I imagine she got in the habit because of her bedbound mother. It made me feel like I was on my deathbed, too. In fact, I appreciated the affection. By Thanksgiving, I'd been hibernating for almost 6 months. Nobody but Reva had touched me. I didn't tell Dr. Tuttle about my blackouts. I was afraid she'd cut me off out of fear of potential lawsuits. So when I went to see her in December, I just complained that the insomnia had crept up with a vengeance. I lied that I could stay down for no more than a few hours at a time. Bouts of sweat and nausea made me dizzy and restless, I told her. Imaginary noises shook me awake so violently, I thought my building had been bombed or struck by lightning.
You must have a callus on your cortex, Dr. Tuttle said, clucking her tongue. Not figuratively, not literally, I mean, I'm saying parenthetically.
She held up her hands and cupped them side by side to demonstrate the punctuation.
You've built up a tolerance, but it doesn't mean the drugs are failing.
You're probably right, I replied.
Not probably.
Parenthetically speaking, I mean, I probably need something stronger.
Aha.
Pill-wise, I mean.
You're not being sarcastic, I hope,
Dr. Tuttle said. Of course not. I take my health completely seriously.
Well, in that case,
I've heard of an anesthetic they give to people for endoscopies, something that keeps you awake during the procedure, but you can't remember anything afterward. Something like that would be good. I have a lot of anxiety, and I have an important business meeting coming up later this month. Really, I just wanted something especially powerful to blindfold me through the holidays.
Give these a try,
Dr. Tuttle said, sliding a sample bottle of pills across her desk.
Infermiterol. If those don't put you down for the count, I'll complain directly to the manufacturer in Germany. Take one and let me know how it goes.
Thank you, Doctor.
Any plans for Christmas? She asked, scribbling my refills.
Seeing the folks?
Where are you from again? Albuquerque?
My parents are dead.
I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm not surprised, Dr. Tuttle said, writing in her file. Orphans usually suffer from low immunity, psychiatrically speaking. You may consider getting a pet to build up your relational skills. Parrots, I hear, are non-judgmental.
I'll think about that, I said, taking the sheaf of prescriptions she'd written and the infermiterol sample. It was freezing cold outside that afternoon. As I crossed Broadway, a sliver of moon appeared in the pale sky, then disappeared behind the buildings. The air had a metallic tinge to it. The world felt still and eerie, vibrating. I was glad not to see many people on the street. Those I did see looked like lumbering monsters, human shapes deformed by puffy coats and hoods, mittens and hats, snow boots. I assessed my reflection in the windows of a darkened storefront as I walked up West 15th Street. It did comfort me to see that I was still pretty, still blonde and tall and thin. I still had good posture. One might have even confused me for a celebrity in slovenly incognito. Not that people cared. I hailed a cab at Union Square and gave the driver the cross streets of Rite Aid uptown. It was already getting dark out, but I kept my sunglasses on. I didn't want to have to look anybody in the eye. I didn't want to relate to anybody too keenly. Plus, the fluorescent lights at the drugstore were blinding. If I could have purchased my medications from a vending machine, I would have paid double for them. The pharmacist on duty that evening was a young Latina woman. Perfect eyebrows, fake nails. She knew me on sight.
Give me 10 minutes, she said.
Next to the vitamins, there was a contraption to measure your blood pressure and pulse. I sat in the seat of the machine, took my arm out of the sleeve of my coat, and stuck it in for testing. A pleather pillow inflated around my bicep. I watched numbers on the digital screen go up and down. Pulse, 48. Pressure, 80 over 50. That seemed appropriate. I went to the rack of DVDs to browse the latest selection of pre-owned movies. The Nutty Professor, Jumanji, Casper, Space Jam, The Cable Guy. It was all kids stuff. Then, an orange discount sticker on the bottom shelf caught my eye. 9.5 weeks. I picked it up. Trevor had claimed that it was one of his favorite movies. I still hadn't seen it. Mickey Rourke's performance in this is unparalleled. Who knows? You might relate to it. I resembled Kim Basinger, he explained, and just like me, her character worked in an art gallery. This movie inspires me to try new things, he said. Like what? I asked, amused by the thought that he might have the courage to do more in bed than reposition himself to get better leverage. He took me into his kitchen, turned his back, and said, "Get on your knees." I did as I was told, and knelt down on the cold marble tile.
"Keep your eyes closed," he said,
"and open your mouth." I almost laughed, but I played along. Trevor took his blowjobs very seriously.
"Have you seen Sex, Lies, and Videotape?" I asked him. "James Spader in that..."
"Be quiet," he said. "Open up." He put an unpeeled banana in my mouth, warning me that if I took it out, he'd know, and he'd punish me emotionally. "Okay, master," I mumbled sarcastically.
"Keep it in there," he said,
and walked out of the kitchen. I didn't think it was very funny, but I played along. Back then, I interpreted Trevor's sadism as a satire of actual sadism. His little games were so silly. So I just knelt there with the banana in my mouth, breathing through my nose. I could hear him on the phone making a reservation for two for dinner that night at Kurumazushi. After 20 minutes, he came back in, took the banana out of my mouth.
"My sister's in town, so you have to leave," he said,
and put his flaccid penis in my mouth. When he wasn't hard after a few minutes, he got angry.
"What are you even doing here? I don't have time for this."
He ushered me out.
"The doorman will hail you a cab," he said to me, like I was some one-night stand, some cheap prostitute, like somebody he didn't know at all.
Anal sex came up with Trevor only once. It was my idea. I told him I wanted to prove that I wasn't uptight, a complaint he gave because at some point I'd hesitated to give him a blowjob while he sat on the toilet. We tried once on a night we'd both had a lot to drink, but he lost his erection as he tried to wedge it in. Then, all of a sudden, he got up and went into the shower, saying nothing to me. Maybe I should have felt vindicated by his failure, but instead, I just felt rejected. I followed him to the bathroom.
"Is it because I smell?" I asked him through the shower curtain. "What's wrong? What did I do?"
"I have no idea what you're talking about."
"You just left without saying anything."
"There was shit all over my dick, okay?"
he said angrily. But that was impossible. He hadn't even penetrated me. I knew he was lying, but I still apologized.
"I'm sorry," I said. "Are you mad?"
"I can't have this conversation with you right now. I'm tired, and I'm not in the mood to deal with your drama."
He was nearly yelling.
"I just want to get some sleep. Jesus!"
I called him the next day and asked if he was free that weekend, but he said he'd already found a woman who wasn't going to pull pranks for attention. A few nights later, I got drunk and called up Rite Aid and ordered a case of sexual lubricant to be delivered to him at his office the next morning. He sent me a note at the gallery by messenger in response. "Don't ever do that again," it said. We got back together a few weeks later.
"Ma'am,"
the pharmacist called out, snapping me out of my reverie. I put the DVD back on the rack and went to the pharmacy counter to get my pills. The pharmacist's nails made an annoying clicking sound as she tapped her computer screen. I thought she seemed smug. She sighed as she ran each stapled paper bag under the scanner, as though it exhausted her to deal with me and all my mental health issues.
"Check that box to say you're waiving the consultation."
"But I haven't waived it. You're consulting me now, aren't you?"
"Did you have a question about your medications, ma'am?"
She was judging me. I could feel it. She was modulating her voice a certain way so as not to sound patronizing. "Of course I want a consultation," I said. "I'm ill, and this is my medicine, and I want to know you've done your job correctly. Look at all these pills. They could be dangerous. Wouldn't you want a consultation if you were as sick as I am?" I pushed my sunglasses back down over my eyes.
She unfolded the papers stapled to the bags and pointed out the potential side effects of each drug and the potential interactions with other medications I was taking.
"Don't drink with this," she said. "If you take this one and it doesn't put you to sleep, you might throw up. You might get a migraine. If you start to feel hot, call an ambulance. You could have seizures or a stroke. If you get blisters all over your hands, stop taking it and go to the emergency room."
She wasn't saying anything I hadn't heard before. She tapped the paper packages with her long fingernails.
"My advice? Don't drink a lot of water before bed. If you get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, you could hurt yourself."
"I'm not going to hurt myself," I said.
"And just saying, be careful."
I thanked her, complimented her on her gold nail polish, pressed the buttons on the payment pad, and left. There was a reason I preferred the pharmacy at Rite Aid over CVS and Duane Reade. The people who worked at Rite Aid didn't take my moodiness to heart. I'd sometimes heard them cracking up behind the high shelves of pills, talking about their weekends, gossiping about their friends and co-workers, somebody's bad breath, somebody's stupid voice on the phone. I'd come in and bitch at them on a regular basis. I blamed them if a prescription was out of stock, cursed them when the line at the pickup window was more than two customers deep, complained that they hadn't called my insurance company soon enough, were all morons, all uneducated, cruel, unfeeling thugs. Nothing seemed to provoke them to come back at me with anything more than a grin and an eye roll. They never confronted me about my attitude. "Don't call me ma'am, it's condescending," I'd once said. Clearly, the woman with the golden fingernails hadn't gotten that memo. They were all so jovial and relaxed with one another, fraternal even. Maybe I was envious of that. They had lives. That was evident. I ripped into the paper bags on the walk home, threw away all the printed materials, and sunk the medicine bottles deep into the pockets of my coat. The pills rattled like maracas as I dragged myself back through the snow. I shivered violently in my ski jacket. My face, hit by the wind, felt like it was being slapped. My eyes watered, my hands burned from the cold. From outside the bodega, I saw the Egyptians putting up the Christmas decorations in the window. I went in, ducked under the fluttering red tinsel, got my two coffees, went home, and swallowed a few Ambien, and went to sleep on the sofa, watching Primal Fear. For the next few days, thoughts of Trevor called me out of sleep like rats scrabbling inside the walls. It took all the self-control I had not to call him. It took sulfatone and a bottle of Robitussin one day, Nembutal and Zyprexa the next. Reva came and went, blathering about her latest dates and heartaches over her mother. I watched a lot of Indiana Jones, but I was still anxious. Trevor, Trevor, Trevor. I might have felt better if he were dead, I thought, since behind every memory of him was the possibility of reconciling and thus more heartbreak and indignity. I felt weak. My nerves were frayed and fragile, like tattered silk. Sleep had not yet solved my crankiness, my impatience, my memory. It seemed like everything now was somehow linked to getting back what I'd lost. I could picture my selfhood, my past, my psyche like a dump truck filled with trash. Sleep was a hydraulic piston that lifted the bed of the truck up, ready to dump everything out somewhere. But Trevor was stuck in the tailgate, blocking the flow of garbage. I was afraid things would be like that forever. My last rendezvous with Trevor had been on New Year's Eve 2000. I invited him to come to the party with me in Dumbo. I'd sensed he was between girlfriends. "I'll come for a while," he agreed, "but there are other parties I'm already committed to. I'll stay at yours for an hour, and then I'll have to leave, so don't get sensitive about it."
"That's fair," I said, though my feelings were already hurt. He had met me in the lobby of his building in Tribeca. He very rarely asked me to come up to his apartment. I think he thought that seeing the place would make me want to marry him. In truth, I thought his apartment made him seem pathetic, status-seeking, conformist, shallow. It reminded me of the loft Tom Hanks rents in Big. Huge windows along three walls, high ceilings, only instead of pinball machines and trampolines and toys, Trevor had filled the apartment with expensive furniture. A narrow, gray velvet sofa from Sweden,
a huge mahogany secretary, a crystal chandelier. I assumed some ex-girlfriend had picked it all out for him, or multiple ex-girlfriends. That would have explained the mismatched aesthetic. He worked as a portfolio manager in the Twin Towers, had freckles, loved Bruce Springsteen, and yet the wall above his bed was decorated with horrifying African masks. He collected antique swords. He liked cocaine and cheap beer and top-shelf whiskey, always owned the latest video game system. He had a waterbed. He played acoustic guitar, badly. He owned a gun he kept in a safe in his bedroom closet. I buzzed him when I got to his building, and he came down wearing a tuxedo under a long black coat with tasteful navy satin accents. I knew then that inviting him to the party had been a mistake. He clearly had somewhere more important to be, and was going to go there to be with someone more important than me after my hour with him was up. He pulled on his gloves, hailed a taxi.
Whose party is this again?
A video artist represented by Ducat had invited me to her party because I'd handled an important rights situation when Natasha was overseas. All I'd really done, in fact, was send a fax. She's going to be projecting live births from a video feed some guy set up in a village hospital in Bolivia, I told Trevor in the cab. I knew it would horrify him.
Bolivia time is an hour ahead of New York, he said. If they really think they can coordinate births, those babies won't be born until 11, and I'm not staying past 10:30. Anyway, gross.
Do you think it's exploitative?
No, I just don't really want to see a bunch of Bolivian women bleeding and moaning for hours.
He fiddled with his phone as I recited language from the gallery's description of the videographer's work. Trevor repeated words sarcastically.
Tectonic, he said. Quasi. Jesus.
Then he called someone and had a very brief yes-no conversation, said,
see you soon.
Do you even like me?
I asked him once he'd hung up.
What kind of question is that?
I love you, I was angry enough to say.
How is that relevant?
Are you kidding?
Trevor told the driver to drop me off at the nearest subway station. That was the last time I'd seen him. I didn't go to the party. I just got on the train and went back home. I looked out the windows at the darkening sky. I tried to rub the dirt off the glass, but it was impossible. The dirt was stuck on the other side. The trees were all bare and black against the pale snow. The East River was still and black. The sky was black and heavy over Queens, a blanket of blinking yellow lights spreading out into infinity. There were stars in the sky, I knew, but I couldn't see them. The moon was more visible now, a white flame glowing high, while red lights of planes sailing down to LaGuardia blipped by. In the distance, people were living lives, having fun, learning, making money, fighting and walking around and falling in and out of love. People were being born, growing up, dropping dead. Trevor was probably spending his Christmas vacation with some woman in Hawaii or Bali or Tulum. He was probably fingering her at that very moment, telling her he loved her. He might actually be happy. I shut the window and lowered all the blinds.
Merry Christmas, Riva said in a voicemail. I'm here at the hospital, but I'm coming back to town for the office party tomorrow. Ken will be there, of course.
I deleted her message and went back to sleep. Christmas Day, around nightfall, I woke up on the sofa in a restless fog. Unable to sleep or use my hands to work the remote or open the bottle of temazepam, I went out to get my fix of coffee. Downstairs, the doorman sat reading the paper on his little stool.
Merry Christmas,
he yawned, turning the page, barely looking up at me. The sidewalks were piled high with snow. A foot-wide pathway had been shoveled from the entrance of my building to the bodega. My slippers were brown suede, with shearling on the inside, and the salt on the ground stained them with white crusts. I kept my head down, away from the biting air and the joy of the holiday. I didn't want to be reminded of Christmas's past. No associations, no heartstrings snagged on a tree in a window, no memories. Since it had turned cold, I'd lived in flannel pajamas, the big, down-filled ski jacket. Sometimes I even slept in that jacket, because I kept the temperature inside the apartment so low. The Egyptian on duty gave me my coffees for free that night, because the ATM had run out of cash. Stacks of old, unsold newspapers were piled up against a broken window next to the fridge of milk and sodas. I read the headlines slowly, my eyes blurring and crossing as I stared. The new president was going to be hard on terrorists. A Harlem teenager had thrown her newborn baby down a sewage drain. A mine caved in somewhere in South America. A local councilman was caught having gay sex with an illegal immigrant. Someone who used to be fat was now extremely thin. Mariah Carey gave Christmas gifts to orphans in the Dominican Republic. A survivor of the Titanic died in a car crash. I had a vague notion that Reva was coming over that night. She probably wanted to pretend to want to cheer me up. "I'll pay you back for a pack of Parliaments," I told the Egyptian. "Plus a Klondike bar. And these M&Ms." I pointed to the peanut kind. He nodded okay. I looked down through a sliding glass cover of the freezer where all the ice cream and popsicles were kept. There was stuff frozen solid at the bottom that had been there for years, embedded in the white fuzz of ice. A glacial world. I stared at the mountains of ice crystals and spaced out for a minute, imagining that I was down there, climbing the ice, surrounded by the whiteness of the smoky air, an Arctic landscape. There was a row of old Häagen-Dazs down there, from before they changed the packaging. There were boxes of Klondike bars down there. Maybe that's where I should go, I thought. Klondike. Yukon. I could move to Canada. I leaned down into the freezer and scraped at the frost and managed to pick out a Klondike for Reva. If she brought me a Christmas gift and I had nothing for her, it would fuel her judgment and concern for weeks. I thought I'd also give her some of the fuchsia underwear from Victoria's Secret I never wore. And a pair of jeans. The looser styles might fit her, I thought. I was feeling generous. The Egyptian slid the cigarettes and M&Ms across the counter with a scrap he'd ripped from a brown paper bag.
"You still owe me $6.50 from last week," he said, and wrote down the sum I now owed on top of that, along with my name, which I was stunned he knew.
I could only assume I'd come down for a snack during a blackout. The Egyptian taped the scrap of paper on the wall next to his rolls of scratch tickets. I put the cigarettes and the Klondike bar and the M&Ms in my coat pocket, took my coffees, and went back upstairs to my apartment. I suppose a part of me wished that when I put my key in the door, it would magically open into a different apartment, a different life, a place so bright with joy and excitement that I'd be temporarily blinded when I first saw it. I pictured what a documentary film crew would capture in my face as I glimpsed this whole new world before me, like in those home improvement shows Reva liked to watch when she came over. First, I'd cringe with surprise, but then, once my eyes adjusted to the light, they'd grow wide and glisten with awe. I'd drop the keys and the coffee and wander in, spinning around with my jaw hanging open, shocked at the transformation of my dim, gray apartment into a paradise of realized dreams. But what would it look like exactly? I had no idea. When I tried to imagine this new place, all I could come up with was a cheesy mural of a rainbow, a man in a white bunny costume, a set of dentures in a glass, a huge slice of watermelon on a yellow plate. An odd prediction, maybe, of when I'm 95 and losing my mind in an assisted living facility where they treat the elderly residents like retarded children. I should be so lucky, I thought. I opened the door to my apartment, and of course, nothing had changed. I threw my first empty coffee cup in the toppling pile of garbage around the trash can in the kitchen, broke back the lid of the second cup, downed a few trazodone, smoked a cigarette out the window, then flopped down on my sofa. I ripped open the M&Ms, ate them and a couple of Zyprexa, and watched regarding Henry, dozing, the forgotten Klondike bar melting in my pocket. Reva showed up halfway through the movie with a huge tin of caramel popcorn. I answered the door on my hands and knees.
"Can I leave this here?" she asked. "If I keep it at my house, I'm afraid I'll eat it all."
"Uh-huh," I grunted. Riva helped me up off the floor. I was relieved that she had no elaborately wrapped gift for me. Although Riva was Jewish, she celebrated every Christian holiday. I went to the bathroom, took my coat off, turned the pocket inside out, and threw it in the tub. I let the water rinse away the melted Klondike bar. As the chocolate flowed down toward the drain, it looked like blood.
"What are you doing here?" I asked Riva when I came back into the living room.
She ignored the question.
"It's snowing again," she said. "I took a cab."
She sat on the sofa. I reheated my half-drunk second cup of coffee in the microwave. I went to the VCR, moved the little elephant statue that I'd positioned to cover the glare from the digital clock. I rubbed my eyes. It was 10:30. Christmas was almost over, thank God. When I looked at Riva, I saw that under her long black wool cape, she was wearing a sparkly red dress and black stockings with boughs of holly embroidered on them. Her mascara was smudged, her face was droopy and swollen and caked with foundation and bronzer. Her hair was slicked back into a bun, shiny with gel. She had kicked off her heels and was now cracking her toe knuckles against the floor. Her shoes lay under the coffee table, tipped over on their sides like two dead crows. She wasn't giving me any jealous, scornful looks, wasn't asking if I'd eaten anything that day, wasn't tidying up or putting the videotapes on the coffee table back in their cases. She was quiet. I leaned against the wall and watched her take her phone out of her purse and turn it off, then open the tin of popcorn, eat some, and put the cover back on. Something had happened, that was clear. Maybe Riva had gone to Ken's Christmas party and watched him carouse with his wife, who she'd told me was petite and Japanese and cruel. Maybe he'd finally ended the affair. I didn't ask. I finished my coffee and picked up the tin of popcorn, took it to the kitchen, and emptied it into the garbage, which Riva had taken out, apparently, while I was washing my coat.
"Thanks,"
she said, when I sat down beside her on the sofa. I grunted and turned on the TV. We split the rest of the M&Ms and watched a show about the Bermuda Triangle, and I ate some melatonin and Benadryl and drooled a little. At some point, I heard my phone ring from wherever I'd last hidden it.
"Is it a vortex to a new dimension? Or a myth? Or is there a conspiracy to cover up the truth? And where do people go when they disappear? Perhaps we'll never know."
Riva went to the thermostat and turned it up and came back to the sofa. The Bermuda Triangle episode ended, and a new one started up, this time about the Loch Ness Monster. I closed my eyes.
"My mom died,"
Riva said during a commercial break.
"Shit,"
I said. What else could I have said? I pulled the blanket across our laps.
"Thanks,"
Riva said again, crying softly this time. The ghoulish voice of the TV show's male narrator and Riva's sniffles and sighs should have lulled me to sleep, but I could not sleep. I closed my eyes. When the next episode, about crop circles, started, Riva poked me.
"Are you awake?"
I pretended I wasn't. I heard her get up and put her shoes back on, tick-tock to the bathroom, blow her nose. She left without saying goodbye. I was relieved to be alone again. I got up and went to the bathroom and opened the medicine cabinet. The Inframiderol pills Dr. Tuttle had given me were small and pellet-shaped, with the letter I etched into each one, very white, very hard, and strangely heavy. They almost seemed to be made of polished stone. I figured if there were ever a time to hit the sleep hard, it was now. I didn't want to have to make it through Christmas with the lingering stink of Riva's sadness. I took only one Inframiderol, as directed. The sharp, beveled edges scraped my throat on the way down. I awoke, drenched in sweat, to discover a dozen unopened boxes of Chinese takeout on the coffee table. The air stank of pork and garlic and old vegetable oil. A pile of unsheathed chopsticks lay beside me on the sofa. The television played an infomercial for a food dehydrator on mute. I looked for the remote control, but could not find it. The thermostat was set in the 90s. I got up and turned it back down and noticed that the large oriental rug One of the few things I'd kept from my parents' house had been rolled up and set along the wall beneath the living room windows, and the blinds were raised. That startled me. I heard my phone ring and followed the sound into the bedroom. My phone was in a glass bowl, sealed over in saran wrap, sitting in the center of the bare mattress. "Huh?" I answered. My mouth tasted like hell. It was Dr. Tuttle. I cleared my throat and tried to sound like a normal person. "Good morning, Dr. Tuttle," I said. "It's 4 in the afternoon, she said. "I'm sorry it took me so long to return your call. My cats had an emergency. Are you feeling better? The symptoms you described in your message, frankly, puzzle me." I realized I was wearing a hot pink, juicy couture sweatsuit. A tag from the Jewish Women's Council thrift shop dangled from the cuff. There were new, used VHS tapes stacked on the bare floor in the hallway, all Sidney Pollack movies. 3 Days of the Condor, Absence of Malice, The Way We Were, Tootsie, Out of Africa. I had no memory of ordering Chinese food or going to the thrift store, and I had no memory of what I'd said in any message. Dr. Tuttle said she'd been baffled by the emotional intensity in my voice.
"I'm concerned for you. I'm very, very, very concerned."
She sounded like she always sounded, her voice a breathy, high-pitched hoot. "When you say you're questioning your own existence," she asked, "do you mean you're reading philosophy books? Or is this something you thought up on your own? Because if it's suicide, I can give you something for that."
"No, no, nothing like suicide. I was just philosophizing, yes," I said. "Just thinking too much, I guess." "That's not a good sign. It could lead to psychosis. How are you sleeping?" "Not enough," I said. "I suspected as much. Try a hot shower and some chamomile tea. It should settle you down. And give the Infermeterol a try. Studies have shown it wipes out existential anxiety better than Prozac."
I didn't want to admit that I'd already tried it, and it had resulted in this strange mess of food and thrift store purchases at the very least.
"Thank you, doctor," I said.
I hung up the phone and found a voicemail from Reva giving me the details for her mother's funeral and reception in Long Island later that week. She sounded soft, sad, and a little scripted.
"Things are moving forward. I guess time is like that. It just keeps going. I hope you can come to the funeral. My mom really liked you."
I'd met her mother once when she'd visited Reva at school senior year, but I'd completely forgotten it.
"We set the date for New Year's Eve. If you could come up early to the house, that would be good," she said. "The train leaves from Penn Station every hour."
She gave me specific instructions for how to buy my train ticket, where to stand on the platform, which car to sit in, where to get off.
"You'll finally meet my dad."
I almost deleted the message, but then I thought I'd better keep it and let my mailbox fill back up so nobody could leave me any more voicemails. My coat was still sopping wet in the tub, so I put on a denim jacket, pulled a pilly knit hat on, stuck my feet into my slippers, my debit card into my pocket, and went down to the Egyptians to get my coffees, shivering violently along the salted path in the dirty snow. The Christmas decorations at the bodega had been taken down already. The date on the newspapers was December 28, 2000.
"You owe this much now,"
said one of the smaller Egyptians, pointing to a scrap of paper taped to the counter. He looked like a lapdog, cute and small and squirrely.
$46.50. Last night you bought 7 ice creams.
I did? He could have been messing with me. I wouldn't have known the difference.
7 ice creams,
he repeated, shaking his head and stretching to reach for a pack of menthols from the back wall for the customer behind me. I wasn't going to argue. The Egyptians weren't like the people at Rite Aid, so I got cash out of the ATM and paid what I owed. At home, I found 7 pints of old Haagen-Dazs on the kitchen counter. I must have exerted great effort in removing them from the depths of the bodega's freezer. Coffee toffee crunch, vanilla fudge, raspberry fudge, rum raisin, strawberry, bourbon pecan praline, and watermelon gelato. It had all melted. I wondered if I'd been expecting guests. The Chinese food spread out on the coffee table indicated a celebration, perhaps, but it seemed as though I'd fallen asleep or gotten frustrated with the chopsticks and left it all there to stink up my apartment while I dreamt. The apartment still smelled strongly of a deep fryer. I opened a window in the living room a few inches, then sat on the sofa and started in on my second coffee. One by one, I lifted each greasy container of Chinese food, guessed its contents, then unfolded the top to see if I'd guessed correctly. What I guessed was pork fried rice was actually slippery lo mein, jiggling around slivers of carrot and onion and dotted with tiny shrimp that made me think of pubic lice. My guess of broccoli and garlic sauce was wrong. That container was full of glimmering, yellow curried chicken. My guess of white rice was a farty, cabbage-filled egg roll. White rice was a vegetable medley. White rice was spare ribs. When I found the rice, it was brown. I tasted it with my fingers, nutty and smushy and cold. As I chewed, I could hear my phone ring. I knew it would be Reva calling to make sure I understood about the funeral, wanting me to promise that I'd be there for her, that I'd show up on time, and to confirm that I was so terribly sorry about her mother's passing, that I cared, that I felt her pain, that I'd do anything to ease her suffering, so help me God. I didn't answer. I spat the rice out and carried all the containers of Chinese food to the garbage. Then I opened each pint of melted ice cream and poured the contents down the drain. I imagined Reva would gasp if she saw all the food I was throwing out, as if eating it all and vomiting it back up wasn't just as wasteful. I took the garbage out into the hallway and threw it down the trash chute. Having a trash chute was one of my favorite things about my building. It made me feel important, like I was participating in the world. My trash mixed with the trash of others. The things I touched touched things other people had touched. I was contributing. I was connecting. I took a Xanax and an Infermiterol, pulled my soggy coat out of the tub, and ran a hot bath. Then I went to the bedroom to find clean pajamas so I could put them on right away and fall asleep to Jumpin' Jack Flash. The furniture in my bedroom had been reorganized. My bed had been turned around so the head of it faced the wall. I pictured myself, in a drugged blackout, assessing my home environs and using my mind, what part of it I'm not sure, to make decisions for how to strategically improve the spatial ambiance. Dr. Tuttle had predicted this kind of behavior. Some activity in sleep is fine just as long as you don't operate heavy machinery. You don't have children, do you? Stupid question. Sleepwalking, sleep talking, sleep online chatting, sleep eating, that was to be expected, especially on Ambien. I'd already done a fair amount of sleep shopping on the computer and at the bodega. I'd sleep ordered Chinese delivery. I'd sleep smoked. I'd sleep texted and sleep telephoned. This was nothing new. But my experience with the Infermiterol was different. I remember pulling out a pair of leggings and a thermal shirt from my dresser drawer. I remember listening to the rumble of the water filling the tub while I brushed my teeth. I remember spitting bloody suds into the crusty sink. I even remember testing the temperature of the bath water with my toe. But I don't remember getting into the water, bathing, washing my hair. I don't remember leaving the house, walking around, getting into a cab, going places, or doing anything else I may have done that night, or the next day, or the day after that. As if I'd just blinked, I woke up on an LIRR train, wearing jeans and my old running shoes and a long white fur coat, the theme from Tootsie running through my head. Chapter 4. Dr. Tuttle had warned me of extended nightmares and clock-true mind trips, paralysis of the imagination, perceived space-time anomalies, dreams that feel like forays across the multiverse, and trips to ulterior dimensions, etc. And she had said that a small percentage of people taking the kind of medication she prescribed for me reported having hallucinations during their waking hours.
They're mostly pleasant visions, ethereal spirits, celestial light patterns, angels, friendly ghosts, sprites, nymphs, glitter. Hallucinating is completely harmless, and it happens mostly to Asians. What, may I ask, is your ethnic background?
English, French, Swedish, German.
You'll be fine.
The LIRR wasn't exactly celestial, but I wondered if I might be lucid dreaming. I looked down at my hands. It was hard to move them. They smelled like cigarettes and perfume. I blew on them, petted the cool white fur of the coat, made fists, and punched down at my thighs. I hummed. It all felt real enough. I took stock of myself. I wasn't bleeding. I hadn't pissed myself. I wasn't wearing any socks. My teeth felt gummy. My mouth tasted like peanuts and cigarettes, though I found no cigarettes in my coat pockets. My debit card and keys were in the back pocket of my jeans. At my feet was a big brown bag from Bloomingdale's. Inside the bag, a size 2 Theory black skirt suit and a Calvin Klein matching nude bra and panty set. A small velveteen jewelry box contained an ugly topaz pendant necklace set in fake gold. On the seat beside me was an enormous bouquet of white roses. A square envelope was tucked beneath it, my handwriting on the front, "For Riva." Beside the flowers, there was a People magazine, a half-empty water bottle, and the wrappers from 2 Snickers bars. I took a sip from the water bottle and discovered it was filled with gin. Out the window, the sun throbbed pale and yellow on the horizon. Was the sun coming up, or was it setting? Which way was the train headed? I looked at my hands again, at the gray line of dirt under my chewed-up fingernails. When a man in uniform passed, I stopped him. I was too shy to ask the important questions. What day is it? Where am I going? Is it night or morning? So I asked him what the next stop on the train would be instead.
Bethpage coming up. Yours is the station after.
He plucked my ticket from where it was stuck on the seat back in front of me.
You can sleep for a few more minutes, he winked.
I couldn't sleep now. I stared out the window. The sun was definitely rising. The train rumbled, then slowed. Across the platform at Bethpage, a small crowd of long-coated, middle-aged people with coffee cups stood waiting for the train coming in the opposite direction. I figured I could get off there and catch that train back into Manhattan. Once the train came to a stop, I stood. The fur coat swept down to the floor. It was heavy fur and tied with a white leather belt around my waist. My bare feet were damp inside my sneakers. I wasn't wearing a bra, either. My nipples rubbed against the soft fuzz on the inside of my sweatshirt, which felt new and cheap, the kind of sweatshirt you can buy for $5 at Walgreens or Rite Aid. A bell clanged. I had to hurry. But as I gathered up my things, I had a sudden and overwhelming urge to shit. I left my bag and the roses on the seat and hurried down the aisle to the toilet. I had to take the coat off and turn it inside out before hanging it up so that only the silky pink lining rested against the grimy wall of the toilet stall. I don't know what I'd eaten, but it certainly was not the usual animal crackers or salad from the diner. I felt the train start back up as I sat there. I pushed up the large sleeves of the sweatshirt to survey my arms, looking for a stamp, or mark, or bruise, or band-aid. I found nothing. I felt again in the pockets of my coat for my phone, found only a receipt for a bubble tea in Koreatown and a rubber band. I used it to tie back my hair. From what I could make out in the dull, scratched-up mirror, I didn't look so bad. I slapped my cheeks and dug the sleep out of my eyes. I still looked pretty. I noticed that my hair was shorter. I must have gotten it cut in the blackout. I could look at my bank card statement to figure out what I'd done on the Infermiterol, I thought, but I didn't really care. As long as I was intact, I wasn't bleeding, I wasn't bruised or broken. I knew where I was. I had my credit card and keys. That was all that mattered. I wasn't ashamed. One Infermiterol had taken days of my life away. It was the perfect drug in that sense. I splashed my face with water, gargled, rubbed the plaque off my teeth with a paper towel. When I got back to my seat, I took a swig of gin, swished it around in my mouth, and spit it back into the bottle. The train slowed again. I picked up my things, cradling the unwieldy bouquet in my arms like a baby. The roses were pristine and scentless. I touched them to see if they were real. They were. Farmingdale was an ugly,